Welcome to the Invisible Capital Podcast with PitchBook, where we shine a light on the traditionally opaque private markets. Here are your hosts, Adley Bowden and Adam Lewis.
Welcome, everyone, to the Invisible Capital Podcast. We're devoting season one to examining the private markets by discussing the work of PitchBook analysts and writers during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Adam Lewis, a private equity reporter for the PitchBook newsletter, and I'll be joined today by Adley Bowden, our head of editorial and our institutional research group, along with senior analyst Hillary Wick. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Adam, this is Adley. Thanks for joining us. Hillary, and excited to be talking a little bit more about the research that you're doing on sustainable investing and impact specifically from your recent note. Maybe get us started just providing all the listeners, introducing yourself and your background and what you're here working on.
Yeah, sure. So I am a senior analyst on the editorial team. I'm focusing on bringing the perspective of the institutional investor to our written offerings. I joined PitchBook in January. But I have over 20 years of experience, mostly in the institutional investor world. I worked at a bank investment department. I worked at a corporate private equity group, a state pension, an institutional investment consultant, and a foundation. Private equity is threaded through many of these experiences, as has the topic of sustainable investing, which is our subject here today.
Yeah, let's start at the very kind of macro level with sustainable investing, because it's, something that's been increasingly out in the news these days. But like, what are the three types that you kind of go into in your note?
Yeah, so, and I'll kind of put it into a little bit of historical perspective. Back in the 1990s, we in the U.S. especially saw a surge in what became known as SRI, or socially responsible investing. That's essentially a exclusionary sort of investment technique. So think of sin stocks like tobacco, alcohol. Some people put firearms or gambling in there, for example. And maybe you believe that those are not things that you support in society, and so you choose not to invest in them. So you exclude those from your portfolio. But in the 2000s, we saw the rise of ESG factors, which is our second category. ESG is shorthand for environmental, social, and governance factors. And these are risks that kind of fall outside of the normal financial statement analysis that we CFAs would have studied. They are things that are risks that are real, however, that are financially material and that could happen and could happen in a big way to hurt you. So think of the idea of an insurance company with clients on the coast of any country where the water is rising. That is a risk that is probably going to happen, and they ought to be able to be planning for that in order to make sure that their business survives it. On the social side, if you're not paying your people very well, they're probably going to walk, which is going to be more expensive to you, and it's going to hurt your bottom line. And on the governance side, if you've got a board that is not independent and kind of does anything that the managers tell them to do, it's probably not going to be acting in the best interest of shareholders or other stakeholders, and that can open itself up to risks as well. So it is more of a risk-based approach, and it is more of something you layer into analyzing an investment as opposed to being an actual strategy. The third area is impact investing, and this is the idea where you are trying to make money. You still want a financial return, but you also want to do something that positively impacts the social or environmental landscape. And so you're seeking out investments that can provide both types of returns, the social benefit as well as an investment return that will grow your capital.
In the note, and just even in your conversation there about ESG, you make kind of interesting clarification, and really I think an important point. There's so much confusion, there's so much kind of press and different definitions around ESG and investing in ESG, but in reality, in the note you'd say it's not a strategy. It's really a framework and factors that one incorporates into the investment process. Can you just talk a little bit more in detail why you don't think it's an investment strategy, and why it's more an investment framework for risk?
Yeah, so there is still some settling in happening among investors when it comes to terminology. There are absolutely people out there that say there are ESG strategies. I really finally got it straight in my head, though, when I realized that ESG factors are really a way to analyze an investment not a description of an investment. So all investments should consider material risks, or all investors trying, seeking investments should consider material risks, whether they're financial, environmental, or social. And all investments have, to some greater or lesser degree, some exposure to non-financial risks. We've certainly seen this with COVID-19 and the social implications of how you treat your employers or your supply lines or whatever else. But not all investments will have measurable impact on a social environmental scale. So a strategy can be created to target some area of impact, but considering ESG factors is just a step in the process of an investment strategy, not a strategy in and of itself.
And as such, does that open up the risk for people to be greenwashing their ESG and using it at the risk or not?
Yeah, that has certainly been an issue, a complaint. I mean, in my prior jobs, I was using the eVestment database, for example, and it's really easy for an investor or, an asset manager to go into that system, check the box and say, we do ESG, but who is going to govern whether they're actually doing it to the taste of the investor who's trying to hire them? I had a conversation or listened in on a conversation with an SEC commissioner this week, and her opinion was absolutely that as long as you disclose, you can do whatever you want. And they're considering naming conventions of whether you can say you're an ESG strategy or not. But considering that how you define ESG is still fairly loose and that it's not a strategy but more of a process, the SEC isn't quite sure where to come down on this topic. So greenwashing may still occur. You still need to look past the naming and ask the hard questions of your asset managers to determine if they're doing what you feel is appropriate.
Has there been any progress made on finding a uniform measurement test for what ESG or impact investing is?
Yeah, there's been some really good work, actually. One of the really interesting bits for ESG especially is SASB, which is the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board. In November 2018, they came out with a framework for companies to use that will help standardize the reporting around ESG. The two great things about this framework is, first, they consulted asset managers, allocators, and companies to arrive at factors that are financially material. There's going to be no mistaking these standards for some touchy-feely tree-hugging thing that a lot of people still kind of put ESG in. These are financially material risks that ought to be considered. The second bit is that the standards are industry specific. So an oil company has different exposure to ESG factors than a bank, and the standards recognize this and provide a template for only the most important factors to each industry. So these standards, they're not required yet by any regulator, but the investor community is actually leading the charge and asking that companies consider using SASB for their sustainable reporting.
And is SASB a European as well as North American, or I guess global framework, or is that just a North American US?
No, it is global. And it is, unlike a lot of ESG really started, and SRI especially started in the public markets, this is a framework for companies. It doesn't matter whether you're public or private. So while I think it started to see more uptick in public companies from the start, there's absolutely nothing stopping investors from asking their private companies to use the same sort of framework.
One thing that caught my eye in the note was the fact that you mentioned European regulators and the CFA Institute have named ESG risks as something that really should be considered as part of a fund manager's fiduciary duty, which opens up a lot of risk to these managers potentially on if they invest in a company that then subsequently suffers from some sort of ESG related detriment. This seems like new ground for these private managers. What's your read on that? And is that going to have legs?
Well, to some extent, a lot of people say that these factors are things that proper investors should have been considering all along.
Right.
And so if you miss it, people don't come after you. They're just seen as an inept manager and people fire you. But it is an area of intense discussion. On the one hand, you've got a lot of vocal institutional investors saying, yes, they want to see reporting on any material risks a company faces, regardless of whether it's related to typical financial statements or not. On the other hand, are people, and included in this is this SEC commissioner I heard just this week, that feel that the way you go about investing should not be regulated. You should just disclose what you're doing, and investors can decide if they feel you're doing it right. For many years, ERISA investors, which are, you know, investors that are managing pensions and 401ks and things that workers are going to be receiving, ERISA investors were unclear about how the Department of Labor felt about sustainable investing, whether you could consider factors other than maximizing profits and still be serving your fiduciary duty. But the Department of Labor did come out a few years ago and say that these factors have the potential to enhance returns, which opened the floodgates to investors who'd held off out of fear that their regulator would disapprove. So, you know, I think to your question, there's still a lot of conversation about it. I don't necessarily think it's a liability because, you know, investors have always had to sort of self-regulate and do what they think is best. And it's kind of up to the investors if they lose money to walk away and find someone who's better.
Yeah, shifting gears a little bit. Do we know yet how the coronavirus is going to impact social, you know, impact investors?
There's certainly a lot more discussion right now around the S of ESG. Mm-hmm. Governance has been something that for a long time, think the times of Enron in the early 2000s, governance is certainly something that people are looking at, that boards are usually much more diverse. Well, they're getting there. And they're at least hopefully more independent than they were 20 years ago. Environment has been coming in, obviously, over the years as more and more shareholder initiatives are focusing on that. But the S was hard to get your arms around. If you didn't pay your workers enough, they could walk, and that was the market mechanism working. But now you've got, you know, hordes of people being laid off, and how are the companies treating them? Are they making them take their sick time for this virus? Are they, you know, what sort of things are they doing to either support or not support? I was just actually listening to a CFA webinar this morning where a researcher from Harvard has been able to take big data on news and come up with signals for whether it's been positive or negative, the news coming out during the period of February 20th to March 23rd, I think. I might have the dates slightly off. And they're measuring to see if you've been getting positive news about your social treatment of employees and supply chain and the way you're shifting your business in this time. How is your stock done? And vice versa, if you've been getting more negative responses, how is that going? And he's been able to prove it was over 300 basis point difference between the ones that are being positive actors right now and arguably had already set themselves up to be thinking sustainably. That's why they've been able to act so well and so strongly during a period of chaos, is that they already had leadership that recognized long-term thinking. I mean, right now, if you're going to treat anybody poorly, it's going to be known. And when the world comes back to the way that hopefully it used to be, people may choose to act with their money or act with their feet and not support your business anymore. And that's really what sustainable thinking is about. And, you know, sustainable equates to long-term. If you're only managing for next quarter's numbers, you may not be able to think in the way you need to in order to get through this crisis.
Back to impact investing, because I want to make sure we touch on that. Unlike ESG, you call impact investing actually a strategy. And Adam, you've covered a number of funds on the private equity side, some very large, in fact, that are defining themselves as impact funds out there to make that double line profit. What are some of the strategies you're seeing? What are some of the kind of the nuances underneath just that idea of double line impact?
Yeah, some are very general, especially those really big ones I'm sure Adam's been reporting on. If the investment leads to a more sustainable world, they'll do it. So they could have in the same fund investments in technology to improve energy usage, investments in private education to improve outcome for kids or adults who need the skills to be competitive in the modern workforce. Or they might have investments in forestry projects that don't leave behind a barren wasteland. At the other end, there are very specific funds created to lend perhaps to affordable housing projects, to support economic development in less developed nations, or to ensure that clean water becomes more available around the world. Keep in mind that while these investments, though, can sound touchy-feely, as you said, there's that double bottom line. Investors in impact do seek a rate of return. This isn't considered philanthropy. But in some cases, for the chance at more impact, investors will accept what's called concessionary returns. So think of the affordable housing idea. If investors were going for maximum profit, the project might fall back on normal real estate protocol by investing, making improvements, but then jacking up rents for maximum profits, which eventually defeats the purpose of trying to create or maintain affordable housing stock. So the investments in this space are usually loans, and they're usually for rates less than market in order to maintain the impact characteristics.
Yeah, just coming at from it from the private equity angle, I was always like a little skeptical in terms of, you know, whether it came down to the bottom line or helping out. You know, private equity's reputation would certainly lean a little bit towards, you know, juicing the bottom line. And yeah, it's been very interesting covering the space over the last 18 months. I feel like it's slowed down a little. There has been, unfortunately, like some bad press among some of the funds that have, whether it was Abrage in 2018, which was a big impact investor that got in trouble for fraud and is since disbanded. Not that it is indicative of the entire impact investing space, but that got a ton of headlines. And then TPG Capital, their biggest impact investment fund, that the head got caught up in the college admission scandal. So that hasn't done much to help the reputation of private equity over the past year, but certainly there are a lot of firms that are doing some really cool, interesting things. Bain Capital's Double Impact Fund, they just made a investment this week, and they've really targeted the healthcare space and like helping nursing homes and other like long-term healthcare facilities. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this pans out over the next 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, and actually it's funny, and Adley, you brought up greenwashing, but another term that I use, it's basically the same thing in the paper, is impact washing. And I was at a foundation just last year where we were seeking out impact investments, and you know, those of us on the investment team were looking at these going, okay, I can sort of see a connection, but they were venture capitalists that were focused just on a very small geography in Minnesota. And we're like, okay, so the impact is basically economic development, but isn't every fund trying to, you know, create better companies that probably expand your employee base and that sort of thing? So it does get a little bit fishy about what's considered impact, and it sort of depends on what the investor's objectives are and whether it might count or not.
Yeah, well, I think this season on Billions, I don't know if you're a fan or not, Hillary, but
it's on my watch list.
We've got a new Axe Cap rival who's of the sustainable investing, impact investing. So we'll see what that does for the image.
Nice.
That's not going to help.
It's not going to help.
He's just like the most ruthless of all of them, but he's like got the Midwestern, like Indiana background. So like super nice on the surface, talks about making a difference, but you know, at his heart still is very good at generating returns for his shareholders.
So yeah, we'll see. Well, Hillary, give us a sense on, you know, what's on the roadmap. What else are you going to look into in this subject? I know it's going to be something that you're going to recover and, you know, help investors navigate this evolving landscape. So just mention kind of what's in the pipeline.
Yeah, we've got two things that I'm really excited about, actually. The first is that in the next month or so, we're going to be releasing a sustainable investing survey that we hope allocators, asset managers, and others such as fund-of-funds, investment consultants, and others that sit between LPs and GPs will respond to. We last did a similar survey in 2016, so we're really excited to see how the trends have changed in the meantime. And the second is that we're working to improve the PitchBook platform to be better able to identify impact funds and the type of impact they're seeking to provide. With that improvement will come the ability both for clients to search for the impact that best matches their mission, but it's also going to help us on the editorial team to produce more analytical work on fundraising, dry powder, and performance in the impact space. So both of those hopefully will be resulting in some papers written by me in 2020.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely look forward to that as things hopefully trend back towards normalcy here in the next few months. Just wanted to thank Hillary for joining us for today's episode. And as always, you can go to pitchbook.com/podcast for the show notes and other relevant materials. I'm Adam Lewis.
And I'm Adley Bowden. Thanks again for listening to this episode of PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast.